Welcome to the Asian House Library Foundation Literature Festival 2016. On behalf of Hamlet Kemba, the Head of Arts and Learning at Asian House, I would like to thank you all for coming tonight. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Tamika Steinfeld, and I run the literature program here. The highlight of the literature program for the festival, which is held annually in May, it started last night and it will continue throughout the month. Tonight we launch The Eye Still Seeks, a wonderful book that looks at some of Pakistan's leading contemporary artists. One of the book's writers, Kamila Shamsi, will lead the discussion. Kamila Shamsi is the author of several acclaimed books, including Burnt Shadows, which was shortlisted for the Orange Prize for Fiction. And she has been translated into over 20 languages. A trustee of Free Word and English Pen, she grew up in Karachi and now lives in London. Joining Kamila on stage is renowned artist, teacher, and creator Sulima Hashmi, who is also the book's editor. There's art historian, critic, and creator Virginia Wiles, and artist Faisal Burton Niza Khan. Before handing over to Kamila, who will introduce the panel more fully, I'd quickly like to say a few words of thanks. Firstly, my thanks go to our sponsor, the Barrow Foundation. A UK registered charity, the Barrow Foundation is dedicated to the advancement of literacy and education, as well as the appreciation of Asian cultures. I would also like to say thank you to Amrita Zaman, who has been instrumental in making tonight happen. Alongside the trustees of the Lahore Biennale Foundation UK chapter, who initiated the event, and the Norman Teaser Foundation, who have supported it. After the talk, Amrita will say a few more words on these foundations. And with that in mind, I would like to hand over the microphone to Kamila. Please join me in giving Kamila and the panel a warm welcome.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming out. It's never easy in one of the first warm days in London to come to a room with the windows closed. But I think we're going to make it worth your while. I'm very lucky to be joined by such an excellent panel. And I'm going to go straight off into the introductions, although I suspect most of you know who everyone is. Starting on my far left, Sulima Hashmi is an artist, curator, and contemporary art historian. Professor Hashmi was the founding dean of the Murray McDowell School of Visual Arts and Design at Beacon House National University in Lahore. She's written extensively on the arts and edited the book that brings us here, which is a fantastic book. You should all have it if you don't already. And buy his Christmas presents or Eid presents or whatever else. The book, of course, is The Eye Still Seeks, Contemporary Art of Pakistan, published by Penguin India in 2014. Sulima Hashmi curated Hand in Fire, an exhibition of Pakistani contemporary arts for Asia Society Museum in New York in 2009, and more recently curated the critically acclaimed exhibition titled This Night Written Dawn, which opened on the occasion of the Delhi Art Fair 2016. She's a practicing artist and has participated in many group exhibitions and has had 6 solo exhibitions at the national and international level. Next to her, Kane is a painter, art historian, and anthropologist. Virginia Wise has worked as a critic, curator, and lecturer in cultural studies for over 40 years in the UK, France, and South Asia. The author of Art and Polemic in Pakistan, Cultural Politics and Tradition in Contemporary Miniature Painting, published by Annie Torres. She has written many articles and curated several exhibitions in India, Japan, Switzerland, and France. Critical Text published in Thirst Text, Art Asia Pacific, Art in America, Flash Art, Friday Times, Times of America, and many other publications. She's currently Associate Lecturer at the University of Art, London, and lives in London and southern France. Next up, we have Faisal Bhatt, who was born in Lahore and trained in the National College of Arts Lahore and the State School of Fine Art. In 1995, she was awarded the UNESCO Ashram Bursary and was artist in residence for 3 months at the Barclay Art Trust in Durban, South Africa. Her work has been exhibited at various art fairs such as Art Dubai and the Hong Kong Art Fair, and extensively in Europe, the Middle East, South Asia, and the United States. Her work can also be found in private and public collections, including the British Museum around the world. Her mid-career retrospect, Farrakhan, opened with a new art exchange in April 2015. It traveled to the art exchange at the University of Essex in November 2015, and is due to open at the Attenborough Centre of Arts, the University of Leeds, in September 2016. And finally, sitting next to me, Nysa Plum Tree at the Ruskin School of Drawing and Fine Art, Oxford, and Wimbledon College of Art, London. Her work has been exhibited internationally, and the first US solo museum exhibition, Kirachi Energies, was held at the Royal Museum in 2013. Nysa curated the Rising Tide, New Directions in Art from Pakistan, 1990 to 2010, at the Mohammad Palace Museum, Kirachi, in 2010. She has also been on the Faculty of Visual Arts at the Indus Valley School of Art and Architecture from 1991 to 2009, and is currently Senior Advisor at the Visual Studies Department, Visual Studies Department of Kirachi University. She is a founding member and former coordinator of the Vassal Artists Collective and the recipient of the Prince Claus Award in 2013. Please join me in welcoming all of them. So we have a lot of women with a lot to say and not an awful lot of time to do it, so I'm going to dive straight into things. Salima, I was looking over the text you've written within the book. And there's a point where you said one resents the label of a national identity. And you said this inside a book that's called Pakistan Contemporary Art, which of course we're aware of. There's another point where you talk about there is an oddly convincing affinity which runs like a river thread between artists who come to studios from across Pakistan. But I'd like you first and everyone on the panel to actually talk about this label of Pakistan, your national identity, and how it sits on an artist or on a critic, and you know whether you have a fraught relationship with that label.
Well, I think it is an issue today when you are increasingly looking at a world in which you know your work is taken in the way that it appears. But there's no doubt that we who live in a particular part of the world go through certain experiences that are reflected in the work. And while not accepting a kind of cliche which inevitably goes with the label which says Pakistani or Indian or Tajik or whatever, you also know very well in your gut that the work does emanate from a state. There is a resentment against the global market, and yet to jostle in that space, the sense of who you are and where you come from is important. I think that while one is worried about the fact that there is already a perception of what it means when you say the word Pakistan, I think that is what artists chaff against. And they really do not want to have those easy definitions. Oh, if it's a woman artist, she's coming from Pakistan, there are issues of militarization, covering, uncovering, and all the rest of it. It's far more nuanced than that. And we know that it's far more nuanced than that. So therefore, I think that when I was offered really to write this book, I thought for a while about this business of contemporary Pakistani art. But the fact remains that the publisher would not have come to me if there was not this, you know, subtext. So therefore, the recourse then was to really dig deep into all the aspects of art making, and not just art making. I think that the very delicate connections that they are between people who, well, like yourselves, and the other writers who've come into the book, because there is a history of people who write and also make art, which is a very old one. And so one finds different ways and different positions when one takes up the challenge of doing a work, which is this book. And of course, one of the challenges was to do with the title. the eye still seeks, and it does hark back to an exhibition that I did in 2001, an exhibition called The Eye Still Seeks, which happened in Sydney. And then, you know, 2015, a book that is The Eye Still Seeks, so what happens in between. And I think the book kind of explained what happened in between.
Do you want to tell anyone who doesn't know where the title comes from?
Well, the title comes from a translation of a poem by Fez, who I happen to be related to. You know, it goes, and the heart still aches, and the eye still seeks, and will not be still. And this togetherness, it will not suffice. It's from the poem which is August 1947, The Dawn of Freedom. And there was reference in the beginning of this exhibition that I curated in Delhi for the Devi Art Foundation, which was based, the theme was this poem. And of course in Urdu, and bear with me if you don't get that thing, Jigar ki aag, nazar ki umang, dil ki jalan. Kisi pe chara hai hijran ka kuch asar hi nahi. It sort of says it all, really. We're talking about this constant pushing and being pushed back, and the fact that that journey is relentless, and it's on the edge of being thankless, but not quite.
Faisal, I'm sorry you rhyme. There's nothing you can do about it. I want you to talk as well a little about that lady of Pakistani, how it sits with you. And perhaps talk about the relationship to place, because you're both artists who lived and worked both in Pakistan and the UK, and your trajectories have been slightly different. So I wonder if you could talk about the sense of being a Pakistani artist. Is there such a thing as a Pakistani artist, a Pakistani artist that you think of consciously?
I think Pakistan believes that she's the new world, but the bigger reality is, overriding reality is that we are sister nation to next door, and somehow the governance has been based on rivalry. And I think underneath the umbrella of that rivalry, generations have grown completely in a bubble, in a nouveau cultural bubble. And as we were talking earlier, I happen to be the Zia generation. I grew up under his regime. But I was just old enough to know that things were better before, as what my parents wore, you know, grassroots level stuff, or, you know, law and perception of women. And then Zia comes, and I always say at a grassroots level, my school changes. I went to a Christian Catholic colonial school, and the uniform changed, we got the Quran lessons, the little things like this television changing, and, you know, back-to-back Quran lessons again. I think it kind of made my household very angry, and my father suffered a little bit under Zia because he resisted it. So I think, in a way, when I reflect on it, I thought this is how the world is, because Pakistan is not multicultural, the one I grew with. It was monocultural. And I didn't have an exposure of the wider world. And I think it's until I went to an art school, and I was very fortunate to be taught by Salima, that, and I'm going to quote her words, that she quoted for her teacher, Robert Hodgkin, last night, that my teacher was my window to the world, and Salima was my window to the world, and how she helped a lot of students and artists of our generation to sort of channel our energies and question ourselves and the kind of in the wider context of society and being Pakistani. I always remind people that I was never given the millstone of Pakistani identity anyway, and a lot of liberal Pakistanis are not. We sort of prided in our Kashmiri heritage, which is like an ethnic heritage. And religion was sort of something that was always left on the shelf and never forefront of her existence. And Zia was kind of on this drive to change all that. So I guess I still look, I mean, I'm reminiscing on that because I believe firmly that where Pakistan stands right now and all the savagery that we hear about has got a connection with that era. And as Sasha was saying, what's happened ever since, and kind of mapping time, I think art has been constantly affected or informed by the society and its changes and all the kind of cultural renaissance that we keep carrying on going through. So I guess not just my own work, there's plenty of Pakistani artists whose work is consistently informed by that. What do you say, Nelson?
Yeah,
I'm trying to come back to your question also. You've covered so many things. I think the idea of identity, national identity, is a double-edged sword. In a sense, it gives you a kind of mantle to project yourself in a particular way on the international arena, although a lot of artists wouldn't want to do that, perhaps. At the same time, it also becomes a kind of a ghettoization of yourself at a time when everyone wants to speak a more global language, perhaps. But I think in reality, the idea of artists working within certain national prisms, you know, it's something that they've resisted consistently. And I think that, you know, there's so many stereotypes you have to work through as you do in literature, probably. But I would say that, you know, to trying to get a better understanding of what kind of art is being made in Pakistan or by artists who are, of, you know, related to this context, is very interesting, because there's such a multitude of connections, whether it's land or geography, whether it's the literature or the politics or the kind of ideologies that, you know, artists are working with. So, I mean, there are many prisms, and I'm sure we will sort of go into that. I think that also there's a lot of resistance to this sort of typecasting. And as you said, you know, if you're a Pakistani artist, if you're a woman, there's a constant reiteration of the same kind of stereotype that you're pigeonholed in. And I find that very difficult. And I think it almost becomes something that you fight so much against that you negate the fact that, yes, you might be a feminist artist, you might be working with the body, and that is a sign of resistance. So I think, you know, all those things are true, but somehow when they become sort of contextualized through prisms that you've not really agreed with, then it's problematic.
Virginia, what's your take on it? Do you think Pakistani artists, writers, get too frozen and hung up on this label Pakistani?
I don't think they do. I think critics outside and curators do. And I think it's become a tool for them. And the irony is that, as you were saying, you know, it's all to do with perspectives between global and local. And the local is so important to have that it's inevitable. And the globalized critic doesn't know enough about the local. So they end up categorizing them under some headline. I mean, it's very interesting to analyze the different reactions around either a text or a show, and to see the extraordinary, I have to say this, although I'm profoundly ignorant myself, but the ignorance of the majority of the critics in the West about, so it's very much what is needed is a local defense, and that's what I'll talk about later, about a homegrown criticism.
I'm
ready.
All right, no, but actually, I want to go back to, because let's go back to the local, you know. Because, of course, the labels and all are something that happen outside of the artistic practice itself. I mean, it's once you've done the art and the art is out of the world, then you, presumably, that's when you start thinking of how you're being sold or what, you know, what titles you're under. There is the practice itself, which I think often gets left out in these conversations around globalization and labeling. So, you know, you mentioned that in 2001 there was an exhibition by the name of the ICOCs, and I'm just going to run through for people who are interested. The artists in that show, there was Salima, Naiza, Anwar Saeed, Mohammed Imran Qureshi, Aisha Khalid, and Ruby Chishti, which were kind of curated by Salima and Surabi. Can you talk about what's happened in terms of artistic practice in Pakistan in the years since, between 2001 and the publication of this book?
You know, when I think back at that show, it was really almost a first sortie of what I saw as people with very promising practices, very diverse, which I think continues today to be the hallmark of art making in Pakistan. I mean, the diversity is staggering and sometimes almost scary, because you feel that everything is being scrutinized by artists. And their life's blood is actually going into what is happening. But also there is a kind of there's a long-term view to it also. So while the immediate is responded to, there's also a great sense of, or great understanding that this can be for a very, very long time. That show, really, it came about because Sue Rowley, who is a curator and a cultural theoretician from Sydney, I mean, she came to Pakistan and she was totally flabbergasted. She came at my invitation. At that time, I was principal NCA and came to do some talks. So she said, you know, why is this work not seen anywhere? And I said, it's because we are making it, and we are very busy making it, and we don't have time to take it elsewhere. So she sort of rolled up her sleeves, and that's how. And the fact that it was Imran Qureshi's first show in Australia, he was later invited to do a workshop. And when he appeared for his visa interview, he told me that, you know, the Aussies are quite sort of critical and difficult with visas, like most people with Pakistani passports. So Imran says to him, he said, what are you going there to do? Imran says to him, I'm a very famous artist in Australia. All of one show, one group show. The man was so taken aback, he immediately gave. But you know, it's a very different response today when you have the same artist who is, you know, showing at the Barbican right now, and I went and saw that very moving exhibition. So I think there's been a transformation which has come about totally on its own merit, because people were constrained to see what was happening in the most unexpected of places, in the most unexpected of ways. And to me, that is the key to it. Every week these days, there is, you know, out of 10 or 12 exhibitions that are happening in Karachi, Lahore, and Islamabad, there's at least one which makes you pause and you say, where did this come from? You know, when everything is loaded against it, when there are no resources, there's no patronage, there's not even a market, but the work is happening. And therefore, to me, this period has been fertile. It has been inspirational. And most of the time, I mean, I don't really bother about what the critics say in the West, because it is so, it's just enriching to be there. It's just amazing.
Both of you have also been, through this period, you were working, let's say, the end of the 20th century and into the 21st. Do you also have this feeling that in the last 10, 15 years, there's been some kind of shift, some gap? Because I certainly know that with Pakistani writing, it's a very similar period that sort of, you know, around 2000, 2001, things start happening. I don't know English language writing, of course, in the other languages, things have been going on for a very long time. But certain things start happening, although it's still very limited within that world. It's, the 21st century seemed to have set off something different. And I wonder whether you feel this is so in terms of, A, your own work, do you feel as though you've become very different artists over time, but also the work of your contemporaries?
Well, I mean, living in Karachi through these years, I think across Pakistan, I mean, one of the major things was 9/11. Mm-hmm. So towards the end of that year in 2001, you know, we were sort of faced with this kind of global tragedy, and the impact of it on our country was equally immense, with about 1.5 million refugees coming in from Afghanistan. So, I mean, on the political front, I think that was one major impact. I think on another level, in these 15 years, I feel that, you know, the mobility that artists have had in so many ways, I think that word mobility is an interesting word to sort of take apart, because there's been a kind of ambition, I think, which comes out of the possibilities that are enabled, you know, through moving and traveling and doing workshops and residencies. So I think that kind of exposure and that sort of self-referential measurement of where do I stand in this global space became quite a, I think the ripple effect of that was important because a lot of artists were exposed across these 15 years to various kinds of opportunities, which I don't think that that was happening too much before, or if they were happening in a very kind of, you know, specific sort of narrow framework. So I think that sense of ambition and that sense of inhaling and exhaling your presence in the world
takes
longer.
Yes,
that's
nice.
I was exhaling in a very different way. So I think those are things in my mind. I mean, one on the political front, one on the sense of, you know, this kind of tremendous growth, personal growth that artists had. And I think probably the art market is well responding to, in some ways, to the sense of, or the vacuum of institutions leading to a kind of empowerment of the market, which I feel is a particular phenomenon at the moment.
I think you've covered it, Naza, but I would say that, I mean, this is the internet revolution of how it's created this hyperconnectivity has its influence. I go home and I see the work of artists there, and I realize that they're very well informed of the latest shows happening here because I've seen them online and they've absorbed quite a bit. And in my time, like in the dinosaur age, it wasn't like that. And you kind of worked for the people that surrounded you, and you wanted to talk to them. But now, I mean, at that time, you can count on your fingertips how many art practitioners had Western exposure. But now there's so many with strong educational institutes in Pakistan, like Beacon House and NCA. There is a lot of students coming and studying here, taking that information back, and very aware of the global language. So I guess that has really revolutionized Pakistani art stage. I think for me, I always believe that being a Pakistani or being from Pakistan is a quality I bring, and it continues to enrich my work. I never consciously mask that, because I know that having lived in Britain for 2 decades, that had I not been raised there in those eras, I wouldn't have been as critical and as opinionated as I am. And I did find the slave was very political, and they were struggling to understand me. But somehow I kept my resolve, because I thought, whether I sound like an idiot or not, I have to be true to myself. And I realized that remains the energy that people connect to at the end of the day. So I have to kind of go through my heart and sort of blood and sweat journey to arrive there. And that's what matters to me, because I always ask myself, why do I make art? You know, market and everything, all these forces are at one side. At the end of the day, I make art, because this is the most honest thing that I can do. So I guess on the same breath, I say that's why Pakistani art is so unique, so incredible, and so well received globally, because it talks at that instinctive level to a wider universal audience. So within that, I guess, lays the information of what it means to be Pakistani, an artist.
Virginia, let's talk about wider audience and to go back to the work of critics, because, you know, you do have, in some ways, a relatively new sort of genre of art, let's say, if we're going to call Pakistani art a genre, or within that, say, the miniature tradition within Pakistan, which you've written about, what are some of the critical responses, and what are ways in which critics are moving fast if they are just sort of seeing Pakistan through the lens of war, terror, 9/11, Malcolm Lowe's, all of that?
Well, by chance, I picked up this old photocopy I had, and I think I'm going to read it briefly to see that, of course, there's, on the whole, a rapturous reception now, and it has grown for the miniatures, but I'd like to read an example of the first critique by Akbar Naqvi, who you all know, and he said... This last exhibition of Qureshi is yet another doubtful gift from Lahore, a demonstration of the ridiculous postmodernism of Pakistan, where teachers encourage freedom and produce prodigies who, for want of discipline, scavenge art from the West. This is how creativity is taught and produced in the country without any sense of irony, shame, or doubt. There is a market for this kind of mediocrity. Kiresh's paintings did not map any new oceans and shores. His heroes were the grimacing ghosts of Duchamp, Twombly, and others. Kureshi was playing Europe's game of destruction and pacification. There is a profound difference between the universalism of our traditional art and the globalism of Western art, which was reflected painfully in this showing. So you can see what they were up against at the beginning, and some aspects of that still go on. But I have to say that in, well, it's now, what, 17 years of work on and off, well, that's from 99 in Pakistan, things have changed enormously. And I think that there's a critical apprehension and articulacy that's coming out of the students who have traveled, the artists who have traveled, the fact that artists are gaining confidence to not just articulate about their own work, but to select other works and to make group. So there's an alternative group body that's happening out of necessity. And that necessity is because there's never been any really serious teaching of art history in Pakistan. Can I read a little thing more? Are you boring?
No, no.
Sorry. This is because I don't think I can remember it. I think it's interesting is that because my reflection on it is a mixture of art history and ethnography, because I'm a pseudo-anthropologist, I think that, although I'm a doctor of anthropology, but there is a way of revisiting history as a critical ethnographer. And I think this is what this book is doing, for me anyway, which is creating a new, suggesting, not yet creating, but it's forming a new kind of art history. And I just want to acknowledge a critique made by, sadly she can't be with us today, but Madeleine Clements, who's a very interesting theorist and critical theorist and lecturer now in England, but who lived for years in Pakistan, on South Asian literature. And I was at her wedding 2 weeks ago with a sculptor from Pakistan, and they've had great difficulty in having, but it was thrilling to see, but she's not too well. But I just want to say that she did a delightful review of the book, of Salima's book, and she said, the images are amazing, which they are in the book, you have. But what distinguishes The Eye Still Seeks is not solely the art work that it contains, but the way those are framed by the creative writers, artists, and critics, whose essays, reflections, and conversations are interweaved between them. And a year ago, I was invited to the Lahore Literary Festival to talk about the book, and it was very interesting to hear two talks before, one by Aisha Jalal, the great Pakistani historian, who stated that Pakistan was taught ideology, not history. And the great Indian art historian, who was the prime speaker, Romila Thapar, underlined the importance of ethnography over history, over theology, particularly over theology. In the same context, there was a debate on a Pakistani modernist artist, Imran Mir, a very interesting artist who has suffered from neglect. He died in 2014. And this confirmed the lack of development of an indigenous art history in Pakistan, especially if you do that endless rivalry comparison with sister India. And I voice my reflections that this, in a way, this very lack, this lacuna, somehow incites the invention of making art history work through a different kind of documentation. And what this book shows is the contrasting perspectives offer up a new vista, different from the familiar orthodox approach. Because why? They're based on an intimacy between artists and writers that have been nurtured in a context under permanent threat, socio-political and physical. And this networking's evolved over the last 15 years of my ethnographic experience there. It's expanding on from conversation. I put away from, but it's not yet left conversation, but it's moving on from conversation, for reasons of temporal and spatial pressures, towards a different methodological bricolage, this is the result of digital technology. This is where I think what you just said. Internet has created a global terrain of local contact that Mao makes a certain theses of traveling concepts seem antiquated and yet vital to visit. This is because the opportunities of social media, at once seductive and yet dangerous. In a talk in Delhi the year before, Ravi Sundaram said, the revolutionary tool of cell phone videos in the Syrian war imposes a new media ecology, a political ecology of the senses. The overwhelming sense that I had that Facebook is running viral amongst dark practitioners in Pakistan might suggest an absence of political ecology, whereby former conversations are reduced to sound bites. That's a profound fear I have because I don't get on very well with Facebook. But why this is happening or risks happening offers a subject for ethnographic research that would contribute towards a different kind of art history. This is what I'm saying. One concerned with social interjections and interactions in those terms prescribed by Alfred Gell, which is the object of an anthropological theory of art, to account for the production and circulation of art objects as a function of the relational context. And that's really what I find so extraordinary in Lahore and Karachi, is this relational context between artists, artists and artists, women and women, artists and women, but writers and artists.
But let's talk about, you know, even as I'm sitting here, I'm aware that in this conversation, there's this movement between globalization, the Western world, digital, and the local, and not to talk about the local. And I think one of the aspects of the local that is particularly important, and Martin Korsler brings it up in his introduction, you mentioned it, and Virginia just mentioned it as well, or alluded to it, is, and Faisal referred to it, is the relationship of the artist, academic, and student. And Martin, in fact, in his introduction, says one of the most striking differences between the Indian art scene and the Pakistani one is in Pakistan, your best artists are also teachers, and they're teaching the next generation, and that you don't, it's a very rare thing. So can you talk a little, because of course, you know, two of you here are, or have been, both artists and teachers of it. And Faisal, you've seen the other end as being Sayyidina's student. What does it add? What does it bring? Does it exist because there was some vacuum? Or, I mean, what made that condition arise where you did have and continue to have so many excellent artists giving so much of their time to teach the next generation?
I think it is a peculiar situation in Pakistan. It is something that people remark on when they come from elsewhere. The fact that very well-known artists who have established careers take the time and focus on the classroom, the studio. Huma Mulji is here, and we are furious with her for not being in Lahore. But we, you know, somebody in Plymouth is getting the pen, you know, getting her attention. But I think that this happened really in the 50s onwards, because with the evolving of the art schools, especially the National College of Arts, when Shakir Ali took over as the principal, you had a person who was fairly radical in his views take over the National College of Arts, where a peculiar sort of environment evolved. And the first graduating class, which consisted of people like Zahurullah Clark and Ahmed Khan and Bashir Mirza and so on, they all went back into teaching, and the idea was that, all right, you got the benefit of some amazing teachers, and you know, it sat on your shoulders like a burden and you had to give back. Later on, I mean, hardly 5 or 7 years later, when the political situation became untenable in Pakistan, the art school became a fortress, because you could barricade yourself inside that space where there was freedom, where there was the opportunity to discuss, to talk about what was going on outside without being, you know, hauled off to jail. It was the place where, after all, Colin David in a sort of magazine like this, passing round, and he says, "Don't tell anybody." And he opens it, and there's a really horrifying caricature of General Ziaulak looking like Dracula. And he closes it back like this. You know, this is a kind of, this is a dirty picture, you know, going around. But the fact that it seems, you know, funny now, but at that time, it, you know, Pakistan were, in Pakistan, people were hanged for passing, you know, pamphlets in buses, you know, four young boys, 15 years old, who were passing pamphlets in an omnibus in Lahore. They were hauled up before a military court and they were hanged the third day. So we were living in that kind of an environment. So to have an institution where there was a possibility of being with people by yourself and being protected, I think because everybody hung together. I mean, there was a situation, I've quoted this many times, my first year class, there would be a character sitting in the back who was not my student. And I came and asked the principal, "Who is this person?" And she said, "Keep quiet, it's a military intelligence guy sitting there, you know." I don't know what he got out of my class. But she said, "We just have to, you know, this is part of the deal. They leave us alone because we allow them to report on everything that we're saying." So, you know, one went through that period, but emerged, unlike most institutions in Pakistan, unlike most universities in Pakistan, we emerged more or less unscathed, really. I mean, there were a lot of compromises that had to be made, but the fact remained that because the student body and the teachers were extremely united, whatever their, you know, internal rifts were with them, that we, okay, I don't believe that so-and-so is a great artist and this is not my way. But when it came to the institution and the independence of it, everybody felt it. And it survived. And I think that that peculiar period of 11 years, I think, bred a whole generation, which then I think went on to teach, to work, and something emerged out of that.
I would just add to that that, I mean, those 11 years were very specific and they were very, you know, it was a very conflicted sort of time. But teaching in Karachi over the last 24 years, I feel, you know, I'm hearing something and I feel like, but it hasn't changed very much.
Not true.
And I wouldn't say that so categorically, but I would certainly say that the social space is certainly quite hostile.
Very.
And so the art college really becomes a haven. Again, it becomes that bastion. It becomes a kind of oasis where there's a certain kind of freedom. I mean, in Karachi University, the rangers are still positioned at the entrance gates, and the chai wala still has a little table where only the rangers sit, and the van is sitting next to the visual studies department building. So there's a military presence in the university. But apart from that, the art college, whether it's Indus Valley or Karachi University, you know, it really becomes a space for people to have some freedom, for the students to hang out together, to date, to socialize. But on an academic level also, it becomes a space where, you know, you're creating kind of milieu, which is what you talked about and have always talked about with NCA, that, you know, you have to create a milieu, you have to create the fabric out of which you can generate and you can feed off yourself as well. I mean, as an artist, I feel, you know, you can't live in isolation, you can't create in isolation. And so I think part of teaching in a place like Karachi, because that's my direct experience, and in Lahore too, in some at some points, you know, you're creating a social milieu and you're creating a space which is fertile so that you can also live under that, the shade of that kind of, you know, space.
I think it also proves that it can be done, that there's nothing wrong with, you know, with the creative spirit. It's possible that it's, if it's given that opportunity, it will thrive. And yet, today, in certain ways, it is far more difficult because the threat is no longer from one source.
Yeah.
The threat is everywhere. And therefore, one knows that, you know, at BNU, which is what I have been connected with for the last 12, 13 years, you are in a very strange position of telling a student that, listen, that work might put you in danger. You know what I'm talking about. Because it's not that the state is a threat. The threat is the fact that somebody might take umbrage and that there would be the stigma of blasphemy, and no one will be able to save you, but no one. So therefore, it's a much more delicate balance, and individuals have to negotiate apart from the institution as such. So we find that, you know, it's the space is shrinking in certain ways. So it continues. We like to think of that period, Zia-ul-Haq's period. Okay, that was when the state was. You knew that, you know, where the lines were drawn. Now you don't, and that makes it far more difficult. And for the artist, I think the dangers, like for the writer, for journalists, for activists, for human rights defenders, all of these people, it's a very, very difficult terrain.
And don't you feel that, this sort of seemingly open sort of space that we feel is more liberal now is actually equally dangerous? Because
yes.
At that time, you had the galleries supporting the artists, you had the, you had the foreign ambassadors coming to Rohtas to make sure that, culture is supported because there's a military regime. And now that there isn't really a military regime, everybody's relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the threat is actually everywhere.
Yes,
and
it is.
It's very precarious. And as you said, the spaces are shrinking.
And therefore, interestingly, the art gets better and better.
I mean, the worry, of course, is the next generation. I was talking some years ago to a group of writers from Singapore, and I very hesitantly, in a roundabout way, because I suspected there was someone from the embassy sitting there, brought up an issue of censorship. And there were, I think, five writers, and four of them said there's no censorship. I can write what I want, and I've written about, one said I wrote about, a gay relationship, and someone said I wrote about this. And the fifth, who was the most thoughtful, he said, you see, the thing is, there doesn't need to be official censorship, because for so long there have been so many things we can't say that now, he said, for the younger generation, it's inbuilt. The self-censorship is inbuilt, and there are certain directions in which the writers will not go, and they don't even realize they aren't going there because they stop so early and just turn in another direction. And I suppose that, I think if you grew up in a sort of Zia generation, you were aware of where the lines were drawn and what the enemy were. And I think it's a sort of interesting thing and a terrifying thing to think what this level of self-censorship could be doing. I wonder if those of you who are working, Salima, are there times in some of your work where you think, I don't know if I want this to be shown in Pakistan, or I don't know if I want this to leave the gallery space?
I think I, on principle, work with issues which I feel are brushed under the carpet because as an artist, I have more curiosity about them. And as I sort of work under the umbrella of the human condition, varied issues to do with gender, to do with identity, they kind of creep in. And it's a very tricky domain, because if I say that some of my work touches human sexuality, then I have to correct myself or in the same breath remind others that I'm not just talking about the act of sex, I'm talking about an issue which is very broad in the artistic context. But having said that, I have shown obviously controversial works with controversial narratives in Pakistan. And Naisa, I think it's in one of your shows that you invited me to Pakistan, and Naisa
General Michelle saw it.
Yeah. General Michelle saw that.
He was sweating. He was about to exit. So
oh, right.
He was
okay.
In a, you know,
well,
when he came to
it
that.
Was an image of two men, you know, kissing. And
it's but, in the book.
Okay, yes. But interestingly enough, I think it was a quiet, it was loved, and no one was hurt. Maybe because only there's an inner core of people that come to those occasions, and they are from those havens, which are art schools, are sort of, you know, connected to the, those bubbles. But paradoxically enough, when I showed something similar in London, someone did get offended and leave the gallery. So, you know, you cannot really predict. But I guess in terms of censorship, well, considering the kind of person I am, you know, the more I would go against the grain, and I would perhaps, as an artist on principle, dwell on it a bit more and investigate it. I guess, you know, what I do has a global audience. I'm very conscious of that. And it's been very well received in Pakistan so far. What do you say, Naza, to that?
Yeah, I think I've always shown my work in the gallery, but as you said, you know, we live in a kind of bubble in Pakistan, and the gallery space is a bubble. But then, you know, you feel very vulnerable because, you know, you don't know at what point the work will be seen or shown, or someone will take offense to it. I remember showing the first exhibition of the Heavenly Ornaments, the armor works, and, you know, there was sort of ideas of sexuality and chastity belts and all sorts of things. And, you know, one of the critics wrote, or she says something like, "Oh, achhi ladki hai vaise." You know, she's like trying to say, she's okay, you know, she's on all right. She's a whatever. And, you know, so in a sense, trying to defend me in her critique, which was published. But there are all sorts of things, you know, it's difficult to say this is about something wider and more, you know, broader, mm-hmm. about a certain kind of experience, and not just that one specific image, because the specific image can really offend. Mm-hmm. Because in terms of the general public, that specific image is, you know, going too far, and it's certainly, you know, against the conservative sort of general opinion. And I have witnessed and seen a lot of work which has, you know, just gone over that edge, and then it's like, you know, a barrage then. You know, you really have to be careful. And you don't know where it's going to come from. And yeah, I mean, certainly I look through my website and I think, should I take those images off? Maybe somebody really is doing some research and I should, you know, filter out some of the things. And it's a problem because you really don't know who's going to take offense at what stage. And you can't go through that process.
But what I'm finding interesting is a lot of younger artists want to go outside the gallery. And they're using walls, and they're doing things for a few hours, or a day or so,
yeah.
And the work is there. And, you know, it's like Aisha Dittoy's red clothes that she put on the bomber jet in China Chowk in Lahore, and she hung all her these red undies and so on up to dry. And the police wala came and said, "What are you doing?" So she said, "You know, I'm drying my clothes." Yeah. So he said, "Oh, but you can't." But he didn't quite know what was wrong. Like, you know, how should we negotiate that? So then she waited till it dry, and then she videoed it, and she just backed it up. So, you know, there are instances of one of her recent projects, or one of my first year students did this. For the Art and Society classes, they decided they were going to make portraits of all major political figures on some wall, some obscure part of Johor Town or somewhere. So they were painting, and pretty soon this policewala came and he said, "You can't do this." So they said, "But it's a college project, and you know, we have to do this. So, and we are videoing it, and we have to tell our teacher that we made this painting." So he thought a bit and he said, "Okay, but then you have to whitewash it afterwards." So they said, "Fine," because I gave them idea, this is a brilliant idea for the work. So they painted all day long, these sort of visages of everybody from Altaf Hussain to so-and-so. And in the evening, then they take a white paint and they start painting it over. And in a sense, it became a much more interesting work and very humorous, you know, and thanks to the police, Wala decided that, you know, the wall should not have these. So I think there's
there's much more of an engagement and a testing, which is perhaps it might be a generational thing. It might be the fact that people have access to internet. It may be that they want to talk to a lot, to a larger audience than we were satisfied with doing. But I do sense that there is a change in the way the art student or the younger artist is actually trying to make their work appear, not necessarily always in the gallery. So that, you know, that's a great thing.
I think artists have always managed to get under the radar and subvert things, but still, you know, kind of not sort of get caught out.
Yes, and I think that's the important thing under the radar, because as you just spoke about, you have to be very careful of websites. The only show that I had censored was in India, in Mumbai, Bombay, of the miniaturists, when they put out an image on their website of one by Wasim Ahmed of Krishna with Marilyn Monroe. Yeah. And they were stormed by Hindutva BJP, and they had to shut the show. They were threatened with burning the gallery down. And that raised, in a way, a very interesting situation. And it was of a protest movement by Indian artists and united and brought it up. So that built up a...
I think we're clear on the fact that Pakistan is not some unique place where there's, you know, censorship. Yeah. We know very well that depending which place you are and who you are, I mean, just ask any Palestinian artist. The context in which they work. And who will know, you know, what censorship is and what difficulties are. So I think that, you know, we tend to think, okay, we have struggled in a particular way, so, you know, we're somehow exalted by the struggle. No, I think that this happens in every society, and there are very different kinds of constraints, and some of them are subtle, so you are succumbing without even knowing that you're succumbing, and then there, of course, there's the lure of money, which then, you know, has an overlay in the way that you then position your work. There are also, of course, very subtle ways of being a victim, and that can add to the allure of the work also.
On that note, the victimhood, I'm going to ask the floor questions, and we don't have much time, so I'm going to ask, I'm sure there are lots of people with views that are interesting, but if you could refrain from the views until the signing afterwards, and just ask directed questions.
I ask you,
it's a question, very short question.
There's a microphone.
Anyone on the panel has read poetry by Amrita Dhamrita?
Okay.
Apart from Sue.
You have? Okay.
No.
No.
Liza had a long time. Second row,
I was the poet to actually ask to have a doubt in that voice. What I was wanting to say was that when you talked about Ajahn Chah's comment on ideology and how that is what they're talking about, would you say that in Pakistan today, because as a gallerist I find it does, whichever government is in power, the perceptions change, various radical elements come out in certain governments, go down in certain other governments. Would you say that?
Yes, I think that's very true. I think that this is currently it's quite a difficult situation. Because there will be no defense, I think, for freedom of expression in any of the arts or writing currently. And this is the feeling that there will be an avoidance of support today. And therefore, you find that it allows those who would like to whittle away what little freedoms there are, to have a very brazen attitude. So yes, it alters. I think also there are some governments which willy-nilly out of feeling that they want to be labeled liberal or that they are They have their eye on how they appear in the global world, would like to assume that there is a certain kind of freedom. And so that does create a space.
Because I found that in General Musharraf's time, strangely enough, things were not as difficult. And as I know, that's when the National Art Gallery, when you did that, all curated the beautiful shows. But I find that in certain governments, which their fundamental beliefs, it is actually their belief. And that's why I mark back to the word idea.
But, sorry, can I just add, Max?
Yeah.
I feel that, you know, it's not just the governments, it's the extreme,
no, yes,
you know, elements
of
society which are really hijacking culture.
Yeah.
And I think it's not just Pakistan, it's India.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
in so many places now, that's what
Bangladesh.
Bangladesh.
Yeah.
You have,
yes,
this kind of hijacking of cultural ideology, identity, and all of that is really, really... I mean, what Virginia said about local defense, I feel like I need to make more armor work so that we can all really come out in a stronger statement or something.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed your conversation. I represent Joe Cumming. I'm a retired surgeon. I'm not a piece of art. I do like it. Or something. And I just wondered if... in Pakistan, could able to educate people to appreciate the controversial art that you would have.
Can I? Can we educate people to appreciate controversial art? Is that, sorry, I hope I'm understanding you right.
Well, I'm talking generally. Controversy is always there. Artists are controversial. But
yeah.
It's just,
I think our cultural frames are really tight. And they are spun out of religious ideologies, of course. And although I have in the past made work which was very true to me or to how I felt I wanted to express, in fact, being based in Britain, you hear the worst sitting here. It feels like it's meltdown over there. Perhaps it's not. Like, you know, you keep hearing these biblical tragedies of massacre of the innocent, as if. And I sort of started to ask myself that, what is going on? Why religion is such a bruised emotion? And do I want to make work which is to aggravate? So in a way, I educated myself to be smarter in how I express myself. For example, I created a piece which was using the word Allah and using it almost erotically with lips. Because the idea emerged that I've seen women very erotically dressed, but they're wearing an Allah pendant as well. Somehow I felt it kind of goes together in the society over there. But then when you displayed, it confused the audience a little bit. They would ask, isn't this blasphemy? And then I'll question back, saying, is this blasphemy? And if it is, then could you please explain it to me, educate me? Maybe I'm ignorant. But they couldn't go any further from that, which really exposes how superficial and shallow our associations are with what we think is controversy. So I do hope that artists carry on making the sort of work which continue to educate or set these standards where we at least start talking about something. I don't think artists can reform a society which is so bastardized with, you know, Zia, Era, and the rest of it. But I do hope that artists continue to carry on their resolve in making smart works which challenge those established ignorant notions, such as blasphemy.
Well, my limited experience compared to Virginia and Selina. At the Mahatta Palace Museum, The Rising Tide, which sort of was on for 5 months, and it's a public museum, you pay 10 rupees and you go inside. And these are all contemporary works. So people from the rickshaw drivers, people coming in buses, government school, children, a lot of people saw the exhibition. I think something like 23,000-24,000 people came to the show. So I think my experience was that I was surprised. And this idea of education is, I think it always runs through everybody's effort. I mean, any exhibition you curate, anything you do, the educational element is always there. Mahatta being a museum, it had to be that, had to be a focus as well. But I really felt that people who came in, just normal people off the street, they walked around and they understood the work.
they understood things, and they came back again and again. And I would get comments like, you know, I mujhe samajh aa gaya is cheez ke bare mein, you know, maybe Murtaza's sort of piece, and you know, all kinds of images rung true with certain kinds of things that they felt. Because again, the work is coming out of that space. So I always feel that the common man, or you know, people who are not art educated audiences or part of any elite who go to just the galleries, I think we really underestimate them. And the conversations that I think we've all had with people who are just, you know, technicians or a cameraman or somebody helping you with your work, an artisan, whatever it is, they always have something very interesting to say and quite well informed from their own perspective.
Yeah, I've always found that people who don't are not self-conscious about the fact that they are, they don't know about art, are very often the ones who are more direct, honest, and get it, you know, get to know what the work is about. And I've experienced that in different parts of Pakistan, different kinds of exhibitions, different venues, and sometimes very unexpected, with fairly conservative audiences who have responded. And recently there was an exhibition that we had put together, the Fair Foundation Trust had put together, of women artists from minority communities, and they were artisans as well as fine artists. And we had very, very robust responses from Bahauddin Zakaria University, from, you know, taking it out into some small venue. So I think that we are, yeah, I agree, we tend to have a very fractured view of what people's response will be. I think that, you know, we will take it in that stride, and if they like it, they'll tell you.
Yeah. Are there any questions in that amount? I'm ignoring all of them. Any questions in that amount? We're on the cusp of that.
And it's related to the audiences. Before you say that young artists were interested in attracting new audiences, and I was wondering, is it just at a local level that, I mean, they go,
so I didn't get the
Do you think younger artists are more interested than previous generations in attracting newer audiences and people who wouldn't necessarily go to galleries?
I wouldn't make a blanket statement about any of that, because I find that more and more we are having artists from very, very diverse parts of Pakistan. The people who 15, 20 years ago would not have been enrolling for art courses and art institutions. And therefore, there is really an array of reasons and an array of trajectories that they figure out for themselves of what they need to do. I mean, I have showing one of the images of work by Heather Lijan. I mean, who's a painter, and he's been doing some wonderful videos. And his most recent work is a graphic novel of the Shakireli. So, you know, because he just suddenly got terribly interested, together with the designer. Heather Rijan is from BNU, the designer, young graduate from NCA. They found one another and they got passionate about taking the life of an artist to a wider public. So instead of something that was really their own practice, they decided, okay, they're going to go into something which is going to be about setting up a conversation about the life of a Pakistani artist, an important modern artist, and just taking it to big audience. So, you know, I think that it's quite difficult to really make a statement about how people are figuring out where they want to go. And therefore, there's a very large number who are using the internet to find residencies, to find how they can end up very, very far from home for a short period of time and then come back and do work in which they might totally switch their practices into a very, very new direction. I think in that sense, yes, globalization has affected the way that people reflect on their own practice and then try and figure out where they want to go with it. But luckily, there's, you know, it is a world in which there are these possible directions.
I just wanted to add briefly that if you consider the appetite for art education, then that is a really good indication of what is to come. Because as you know, more and more numbers of students are going to study art and they're going to go out into the wider world, then it's going to eventually have that trickle-down effect of wider audience outside the core of arts as well, because they will be those connections and bridges to the audience otherwise. So I could see it's a very, you know, fertile ground for new audience developing in perhaps next decade or so. So I guess things are kind of happening.
I would say definitely that there's a kind of trust to engage with public space. I mean, in a place like Karachi, I think when I was teaching at Indus, you know, and education is an important factor, which you mentioned, that, you know, art schools do encourage a lot of experimentation, but also a lot of studio practices. And public art or interventions in the public space, you know, kind of dwindle sometimes. And so it's a difficult thing to manage as a career once you leave art college. I found that that within art education more recently, there's much more drive towards research practices. So even at the Indus, you know, they're trying to encourage a research project, which is not just defined by the paintings you create at the end, but, you know, by the process you take. And the Karachi University has also always been much more about the street. And I used to think, you know, this is the place where the students really need to earn a living at the end of the day, and how come they're doing such speculative work which is not going to earn them any money? I mean, I thought of that, you know, many years ago when I first went to jury the work. But I think in terms of very serious projects, you've got things like the Tentative Collective in Karachi, which has done projections, which is all live projections, video and still images in public spaces, completely out of the wide queue, and you know, to an audience which maybe there are 10 people there who are a knowing audience, and the vast majority is the public space. So it's completely open, and it's kind of bringing in people and kind of giving them that contact, or the artists having contact with them. And then you have a lot of projects that Basel has done, and you have Black Spring that, you know, you were part of recently in the hall, and the Elbeno Foundation,
amazing,
you know, kind of taken on a lot of public space now. So I think there is a real earnest effort to engage the public and audiences, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, the Awami Art Collective did.
I mean,
they've done two projects, but both very pertinent, and also the first was very harrowing, in which they just had a sort of labyrinth created out of jhandis, you know, paper flags. Each paper flag, triangular, had the date and the number of people killed in a particular incident, which had to do with either sectarian violence or violence that was for religious reasons. And it was in the public garden. So it was in the form in which you, as you looked up, you walked through these, you know, paper flags, and you were looking year to year. They're looking at the last 10 years. Year to year, you were reading the numbers, whether it was 1, whether it was 15, whether it was 20, whether it was in a mosque, whether it was a targeted killing. And as you walked through and came inside, came to this heart of the place, you realize you had been taken through the last 10-year history of the amount, you know, that Pakistan's fabric has suffered. And quite impromptu meetings, seminars started, and, you know, you found college students are sitting here and they're discussing and they're remembering, and it cost nothing in the sense it was bamboo poles and there were these little white flags with the writing on it. And it was done, they recreated it for LLF also. But the fact remains that this urge for, you know, small group of people, which includes not only artists but other activists, to then start engaging public through just dwelling on what is happening. And they did the same with Black Spring, with the disappearance of Basant from our lives for reasons, you know, better known to the powers that be, while at the same time there is the orange line which is piercing through the heart of Lobo and devastating heritage sites. So the artists worked on both and worked with people in the old city, in which they actually decided to connect households from the roofs. So while they can't fly kites, they had this orange light, which was a hose with light going through it, and they connected it themselves, and they made this amazing panorama of orange light on the night of the sun. So I think that there are lots of ideas which are germinating and people taking action, and therefore the artist and people who are activists are coming together to, you know, to add dimension to life.
I think that is an excellent note on which to start with. Unfortunately, we do, because I've already run over. I know there's someone here who needs to sign us off, but I want to thank all of you for coming to listen, and please give a hand. Today. The first piece, may I ask you to all join me and thank you all very much for